Teddy telling me how edible I smell. He chuckled and then sighed. I've decided what I want to do, I told him. I want to hear more about you. Ask me anything. I sifted through my questions for the most vital. Why do you do it? I said. I still don't understand how you can work so hard to resist what you are. Please don't misunderstand. Of course I'm glad that you do. I just don't see why you would bother in the first place. He hesitated before answering. That's a good question, and you are not the first one to ask it. The others, the majority of our kind who are quite content with our lot, they too wonder at how we live. But you see, just because we've been dealt a certain hand, it doesn't mean that we can't choose to rise above, to conquer the boundaries of a destiny that none of us wanted, to try to retain whatever essential humanity we can. I lay unmoving, locked in awed silence. Did you fall asleep? He whispered after a few minutes. No. Is that all you were curious about? I rolled my eyes. Not quite. What else do you want to know? Why can you read minds? Why only you? And Alice, seeing the future, why does that happen? I felt him shrug in the darkness. We don't really know. Carlyle has a theory. He believes that we all bring something of our strongest human traits with us into the next life, where they are intensified, like our minds and our senses. He thinks that I must have already been very sensitive to the thoughts of those around me, and that Alice had some precognition wherever she was. What did he bring into the next life? And the others? Carlyle brought his compassion. Esme brought her ability to love passionately. Emmett brought his strength. Rosalie, her tenacity. Or you could call it pig-headedness, he chuckled. Jasper is very interesting. He was quite charismatic in his first life, able to influence those around him to see things his way. Now he is able to manipulate the emotions of those around him, calm down a room of angry people, for example, or excite a lethargic crowd conversely. It's a very subtle gift. I considered the impossibilities he described, trying to take it in. He waited patiently while I thought. So where did it all start? I mean, Carlyle changed you, and then someone must have changed him, and so on. Well, where did you come from? Evolution? Creation? Couldn't we have evolved in the same way as other species? Predator and prey? Or if you don't believe that all this world could have just happened on its own, which is hard for me to accept myself, is it so hard to believe that the same force that created the delicate angelfish with the shark, the baby seal and the killer whale, could create both our kinds together? Let me get this straight. I'm the baby seal, right? Right, he laughed, and something touched my hair. His lips? I wanted to turn toward him to see if it was really his lips against my hair. But I had to be good. I didn't want to make this any harder for him than it already was. Are you ready to sleep? He asked, interrupting the short silence. Or do you have any more questions? Only a million or two. We have tomorrow, and the next day, and the next, he reminded me. I smiled, euphoric at the thought. Are you sure you won't vanish in the morning? I wanted this to be certain. You are mythical, after all. I won't leave you. His voice had the seal of a promise in it. One more, then, tonight, and I blushed. The darkness was no help. I'm sure he could feel the sudden warmth under my skin. What is it? No, forget it. I changed my mind. Bella, you can ask me anything. I didn't answer, and he groaned. I keep thinking it will get less frustrating not hearing your thoughts, but it just gets worse and worse. I'm glad you can't read my thoughts. It's bad enough that you eavesdrop on my sleep talking. Please. His voice was so persuasive, so impossible to resist. I shook my head. If you don't tell me, I'll just assume it's something much worse than it is, he threatened darkly. Please. Again, that pleading voice. Well, I began, glad that he couldn't see my face. Yes? You said that Rosalie and Emmett will get married soon. Is that marriage the same as it is for humans? He laughed in earnest now, understanding. Is that what you're getting at? I fidgeted, unable to answer. Yes, I suppose it is much the same, he said. I told you, most of those human desires are there, just hidden behind more powerful desires. Oh, was all I could say. Was there a purpose behind your curiosity? Well, I did wonder about you and me someday. He was instantly serious. I could tell by the sudden stillness of his body. I froze too, reacting automatically. I don't think that would be possible for us. Because it would be too hard for you if I were that close? That's certainly a problem, but that's not what I was thinking of. It's just that you are so soft, so fragile. I have to mind my actions every moment that we're together so that I don't hurt you. I could kill you quite easily, Bella, simply by accident. His voice had become just a soft murmur. He moved his icy palm to rest it against my cheek. If I was too hasty, if for one second I wasn't paying enough attention, I could reach out, meaning to touch your face, and crush your skull by mistake. You don't realize how incredibly breakable you are. I can never, never afford to lose any kind of control when I'm with you. He waited for me to respond, growing anxious when I didn't. Are you scared? He asked. I waited for a minute to answer, so the words would be true. No, I'm fine. He seemed to deliberate for a moment. I'm curious now, though, he said, his voice light again. Have you ever... He trailed off suggestively. Of course not, I flushed. I told you I've never felt like this about anyone before, not even close. I know. It's just that I know other people's thoughts. I know love and lust don't always keep the same company. They do for me. Now, anyway, that they exist for me at all, I sighed. That's nice. We have that one thing in common, at least. He sounded satisfied. Your human instincts, I began. He waited. Well, do you find me attractive in that way at all? He laughed and lightly rumpled my nearly dry hair. I may not be a human, but I am a man, he assured me. I yawned involuntarily. I've answered your questions. Now you should sleep, he insisted. I'm not sure if I can. Do you want me to leave? No, I said too loudly. He laughed and then began to hum that same unfamiliar lullaby. The voice of an archangel soft in my ear. More tired than I realized, exhausted from the long day of mental and emotional stress like I never felt before, I drifted to sleep in his cold arms. Chapter 15. The Cullens. The muted light of yet another cloudy day eventually woke me. I lay with my arm across my eyes, groggy and dazed. Something, a dream trying to be remembered, struggled to break into my consciousness. I moaned and rolled on my side, hoping more sleep would come. And then the previous day flooded back into my awareness. Oh, I sat up so fast it made my head spin. Your hair looks like a haystack, but I like it. His unruffled voice came from the rocking chair in the corner. Edward, you stayed. I rejoiced and thoughtlessly threw myself across the room and into his lap. In the instant that my thoughts caught up with my actions, I froze. Shocked by my own uncontrolled enthusiasm, I stared up at him, afraid that I had crossed the wrong line. But he laughed. Of course, he answered, startled, but seeming pleased by my reaction. His hands rubbed my back. I laid my head cautiously against his shoulder, breathing in the smell of his skin. I was sure it was a dream. You're not that creative, he scoffed. Charlie, I remembered, thoughtlessly jumping up again and heading to the door. He left an hour ago, after reattaching your battery cables, I might add. I have to admit I was disappointed. Is that really all it would take to stop you, if you were determined to go? I deliberated where I stood, wanting to return to him badly, but afraid I might have morning breath. You're not usually this confused in the morning, he noted. He held his arms open for me to return, a nearly irresistible invitation. I need another human minute, I admitted. I'll wait. I skipped to the bathroom, my emotions unrecognizable. I didn't know myself, inside or out. The face in the mirror was practically a stranger. Eyes too bright, hectic spots of red across my cheekbones. After I brushed my teeth, I worked to straighten out the tangled chaos that was my hair. I splashed my face with cold water and tried to breathe normally, with no noticeable success. I half ran back to my room. It seemed like a miracle that he was there, his arms still waiting for me. He reached out to me and my heart thumped unsteadily. Welcome back, he murmured, taking me into his arms. He rocked me for a while in silence, until I noticed that his clothes were changed, his hair smooth. You left? I accused, touching the collar of his fresh shirt. I could hardly leave in the clothes I came in. What would the neighbors think? I pouted. You were very deeply asleep. I didn't miss anything. His eyes gleamed. The talking came earlier. I groaned. What did you hear? His gold eyes grew very soft. You said you loved me. You knew that already, I reminded him, ducking my head. It was nice to hear, just the same. I hid my face against his shoulder. I love you, I whispered. You are my life now, he answered simply. There was nothing more to say for the moment. He rocked us back and forth as the room grew lighter. Breakfast time, he said eventually, casually, to prove I'm sure that he remembered all my human frailties. So I clutched my throat with both hands and stared at him with wide eyes. Shock crossed his face. Kidding, I snickered, and you said I couldn't act. He frowned in disgust. That wasn't funny. It was very funny, and you know it, but I examined his gold eyes carefully to make sure that I was forgiven. Apparently I was. Shall I rephrase, he asked, breakfast time for the human. Oh, okay. He threw me over his stone shoulder, gently, but with a swiftness that left me breathless. I protested as he carried me easily down the stairs, but he ignored me. He sat me right side up on a chair. The kitchen was bright, happy, seeming to absorb my mood. What's for breakfast? I asked pleasantly. That threw him for a minute. I'm not sure. What would you like? His marble brow puckered. I grinned, hopping up. That's all right. I fend for myself pretty well. Watch me hunt. I found a bowl and a box of cereal. I could feel his eyes on me as I poured the milk and grabbed a spoon. I sat my food on the table and then paused. Can I get you anything? I asked, not wanting to be rude. He rolled his eyes. Just eat, Bella. I sat at the table watching him as I took a bite. He was gazing at me, studying my every movement. It made me self-conscious. I cleared my mouth to speak, to distract him. What's on the agenda for today? I asked. I watched him frame his answer carefully. What would you say to meeting my family? I gulped. Are you afraid now? He sounded hopeful. Yes, I admitted. How can I deny it? He could see my eyes. Don't worry, he smirked. I'll protect you. I'm not afraid of them, I explained. I'm afraid they won't like me. Won't they be, well, surprised that you would bring someone like me home to meet them? Do they know that I know about them? Oh, they already know everything. They'd taken bets yesterday, you know, he smiled, but his voice was harsh. On whether I'd bring you back. Though why anyone would bet against Alice, I can't imagine. At any rate, we don't have secrets in the family. It's not really feasible, what with my mind reading and Alice seeing the future and all that. And Jasper making you feel all warm and fuzzy about spilling your guts, don't forget that. You paid attention, he smiled approvingly. I've been known to do that every now and then, I grimaced. So did Alice see me coming? His reaction was strange. Something like that, he said uncomfortably, turning away so I couldn't see his eyes. I stared at him curiously. Is that any good? He asked, turning back to me abruptly and eyeing my breakfast with a teasing look on his face. Honestly, it doesn't look very appetizing. Well, it's no irritable grizzly, I murmured, ignoring him when he glowered. I was still wondering why he responded that way when I mentioned Alice. I hurried through my cereal, speculating. He stood in the middle of the kitchen, the statue of Adonis again, staring abstractedly out the back windows. Then his eyes were back on me, and he smiled his heartbreaking smile. And you should introduce me to your father, too, I think. He already knows you, I reminded him. As your boyfriend, I mean. I stared at him with suspicion. Why? Isn't that customary? He asked innocently. I don't know, I admitted. My dating history gave me few reference points to work with. Not that any normal rules of dating applied here. That's not necessary, you know. I don't expect you to... I mean, you don't have to pretend for me. His smile was patient. I'm not pretending. I pushed the remains of my cereal around the edges of the bowl, biting my lip. Are you going to tell Charlie I'm your boyfriend or not? He demanded. Is that what you are? I suppressed my internal cringing at the thought of Edward and Charlie and the word boyfriend all in the same room at the same time. It's a loose interpretation of the word boy, I'll admit. I was under the impression that you were something more, actually, I confessed, looking at the table. Well, I don't know if we need to give him all the gory details. He reached across the table to lift my chin with a cold, gentle finger. But he will need some explanation for why I'm around here so much. I don't want Chief Swan getting a restraining order put on me. Will you be? I asked, suddenly anxious. Will you really be here? As long as you want me, he assured me. I'll always want you, I warned him. Forever. He walked slowly around the table, and pausing a few feet away, he reached out to touch his fingertips to my cheek. His expression was unfathomable. Does that make you sad? I asked. He didn't answer. He stared into my eyes for an immeasurable period of time. Are you finished? He finally asked. I jumped up. Yes. Get dressed. I'll wait here. It was hard to decide what to wear. I doubted there were any etiquette books detailing how to dress when your vampire sweetheart takes you home to meet his vampire family. It was a relief to think the word to myself. I knew I shied away from it intentionally. I ended up in my only skirt, long, khaki-colored, still casual. I put on the dark blue blouse he'd once complimented. A quick glance in the mirror told me my hair was entirely impossible, so I pulled it back into a ponytail. Okay, I bounced down the stairs. I'm decent. He was waiting at the foot of the stairs, closer than I'd thought. And I bounded right into him. He steadied me, holding me a careful distance away for a few seconds before suddenly pulling me closer. Wrong again, he murmured in my ear. You are utterly indecent. No one should look so tempting. It's not fair. Tempting how? I asked. I can change. He sighed, shaking his head. You are so absurd. He pressed his cool lips delicately to my forehead. And the room spun. The smell of his breath made it impossible to think. Shall I explain how you are tempting me? He said. It was clearly a rhetorical question. His fingers traced slowly down my spine, his breath coming more quickly against my skin. My hands were limp on his chest and I felt lightheaded again. He tilted his head slowly and touched his cool lips to mine for the second time, very carefully, parting them slightly. And then I collapsed. Bella? His voice was alarmed as he caught me and held me up. You made me faint, I accused him dizzily. What am I going to do with you? He groaned in exasperation. Yesterday I kiss you and you attack me. Today you pass out on me. I laughed weakly, letting his arms support me while my head spun. So much for being good at everything, he sighed. That's the problem. I was still dizzy. You're too good. Far, far too good. Do you feel sick? He asked. He'd seen me like this before. No, that wasn't the same kind of fainting at all. I don't know what happened. I shook my head apologetically. I think I forgot to breathe. I can't take you anywhere like this. I'm fine, I insisted. Your family's going to think I'm insane anyway. What's the difference? He measured my expression for a moment. I'm very partial to that color with your skin, he offered unexpectedly. I flushed with pleasure and looked away. Look, I'm trying really hard not to think about what I'm about to do, so can we go already? I asked. And you're worried not because you're headed to meet a house full of vampires, but because you think those vampires won't approve of you, correct? That's right, I answered immediately, hiding my surprise at his casual use of the word. He shook his head. You're incredible. I realized as he drove my truck out of the main part of town that I had no idea where he lived. We passed over the bridge at the Kalawa River, the road winding northward, the houses flashing past us growing farther apart, getting bigger. And then we were past the other houses altogether, driving through misty forest. I was trying to decide whether to ask or be patient when he turned abruptly onto an unpaved road. It was unmarked, barely visible among the ferns. The forest encroached on both sides, leaving the road ahead only discernible for a few meters as it twisted, serpent-like, around the ancient trees. And then, after a few miles, there was some thinning of the woods, and we were suddenly in a small meadow, or was it actually a lawn? The gloom of the forest didn't relent, though, for there were six primordial cedars that shaded an entire acre with their vast sweep of branches. The trees held their protecting shadow right up to the walls of the house that rose among them, making obsolete the deep porch that wrapped around the first story. I don't know what I had expected, but it definitely wasn't this. The house was timeless, graceful, and probably 100 years old. It was painted a soft, faded white. 3 stories tall, rectangular, and well-proportioned. The windows and doors were either part of the original structure or a perfect restoration. My truck was the only car in sight. I could hear the river close by, hidden in the obscurity of the forest. Wow. You like it? He smiled. It has a certain charm. He pulled the end of my ponytail and chuckled. Ready? He asked, opening my door. Not even a little bit. Let's go. I tried to laugh, but it seemed to get stuck in my throat. I smoothed my hair nervously. You look lovely. He took my hand easily without thinking about it. We walked through the deep shade up to the porch. I knew he could feel my tension. His thumb rubbed soothing circles into the back of my hand. He opened the door for me. The inside was even more surprising, less predictable than the exterior. It was very bright, very open, and very large. This must have originally been several rooms, but the walls had been removed from most of the first floor to create one wide space. The back south-facing wall had been entirely replaced with glass, and beyond the shade of the cedars, the lawn stretched bare to the wide river. A massive curving staircase dominated the west side of the room. The walls, the high beam ceiling, the wooden floors, and the thick carpets were all varying shades of white. Waiting to greet us, standing just to the left of the door, on a raised portion of the floor by a spectacular grand piano, were Edward's parents. I'd seen Dr. Cullen before, of course, yet I couldn't help but be struck again by his youth, his outrageous perfection. At his side was Esme, I assumed, the only one of the family I'd never seen before. She had the same pale, beautiful features as the rest of them. Something about her heart-shaped face, her billows of soft, caramel-colored hair, reminded me of the ingenues of the silent movie era. She was small, slender, yet less angular, more rounded than the others. They were both dressed casually in light colors that matched the inside of the house. They smiled in welcome, but made no move to approach us. Trying not to frighten me, I guessed. Carlyle? Esme? Edward's voice broke the short silence. This is Bella. You're very welcome, Bella. Carlyle's step was measured, careful, as he approached me. He raised his hand tentatively, and I stepped forward to shake hands with him. It's nice to see you again, Dr. Cullen. Please, call me Carlyle. Carlyle. I grinned at him, my sudden confidence surprising me. I could feel Edward's relief at my side. Esme smiled and stepped forward as well, reaching for my hand. Her cold, stone grasp was just as I expected. It's very nice to know you, she said sincerely. Thank you. I'm glad to meet you too. And I was. It was like meeting a fairy tale, Snow White in the flesh. Where are Alice and Jasper? Edward asked, but no one answered, as they had just appeared at the top of the wide staircase. Hey, Edward, Alice called enthusiastically. She ran down the stairs, a streak of black hair and white skin, coming to a sudden and graceful stop in front of me. Carlyle and Esme shot warning glances at her, but I liked it. It was natural, for her anyway. Hi, Bella, Alice said, and she bounced forward to kiss my cheek. If Carlyle and Esme had looked cautious before, they now looked staggered. There was shock in my eyes, too, but I was also very pleased that she seemed to approve of me so entirely. I was startled to feel Edward stiffen at my side. I glanced at his face, but his expression was unreadable. You do smell nice. I never noticed before, she commented, to my extreme embarrassment. No one else seemed to know quite what to say. And then Jasper was there, tall and leonine. A feeling of ease spread through me, and I was suddenly comfortable despite where I was. Edward stared at Jasper, raising one eyebrow, and I remembered what Jasper could do. Hello, Bella, Jasper said. He kept his distance, not offering to shake my hand. But it was impossible to feel awkward near him. Hello, Jasper. I smiled at him shyly, and then at the others. It's nice to meet you all. You have a very beautiful home, I added conventionally. Thank you, Esme said. We're so glad that you came. She spoke with feeling, and I realized that she thought I was brave. I also realized that Rosalie and Emmett were nowhere to be seen, and I remembered Edward's too innocent denial when I'd asked him if the others didn't like me. Carlyle's expression distracted me from this train of thought. He was gazing meaningfully at Edward with an intense expression. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Edward nod once. I looked away, trying to be polite. My eyes wandered again to the beautiful instrument on the platform by the door. I suddenly remembered my childhood fantasy that, should I ever win a lottery, I would buy a grand piano for my mother. She wasn't really good. She only played for herself on our secondhand upright, but I loved to watch her play. She was happy, absorbed. She seemed like a new, mysterious being to me then, someone outside the mom persona I took for granted. She'd put me through lessons, of course, but like most kids, I whined until she let me quit. Esme noticed my preoccupation. Do you play? She asked, inclining her head toward the piano. I shook my head. Not at all. But it's so beautiful. Is it yours? No, she laughed. Edward didn't tell you he was musical. No. I glared at his suddenly innocent expression with narrowed eyes. I should have known, I guess. Esme raised her delicate eyebrows in confusion. Edward can do everything, right? I explained. Jasper snickered, and Esme gave Edward a reproving look. I hope you haven't been showing off. It's rude, she scolded. Just a bit, he laughed freely. Her face softened at the sound, and they shared a brief look that I didn't understand, though Esme's face seemed almost smug. He's been too modest, actually, I corrected. Well, play for her, Esme encouraged. You just said showing off was rude, he objected. There are exceptions to every rule, she replied. I'd like to hear you play, I volunteered. It's settled then. Esme pushed him toward the piano. He pulled me along, sitting me on the bench beside him. He gave me a long, exasperated look before he turned to the keys. And then his fingers flowed swiftly across the ivory, and the room was filled with a composition so complex, so luxuriant, it was impossible to believe only one set of hands played. I felt my chin drop, my mouth open in astonishment, and heard low chuckles behind me at my reaction. Edward looked at me casually, the music still surging around us without a break, and winked. Do you like it? You wrote this? I gasped, understanding. He nodded. It's Esme's favorite. I closed my eyes, shaking my head. What's wrong? I'm feeling extremely insignificant. The music slowed, transforming into something softer. And to my surprise, I detected the melody of his lullaby weaving through the profusion of notes. You inspired this one, he said softly. The music grew unbearably sweet. I couldn't speak. They like you, you know, he said conversationally. Esme especially. I glanced behind me, but the huge room was empty now. Where did they go? Very subtly giving us some privacy, I suppose. I sighed. They like me, but Rosalie and Emmett, I trailed off, not sure how to express my doubts. He frowned. Don't worry about Rosalie, he said, his eyes wide and persuasive. She'll come around. I pursed my lips skeptically. Emmett? Well, he thinks I'm a lunatic, it's true, but he doesn't have a problem with you. He's trying to reason with Rosalie. What is it that upsets her? I wasn't sure if I wanted to know the answer. He sighed deeply. Rosalie struggles the most with what we are. It's hard for her to have someone on the outside know the truth, and she's a little jealous. Rosalie is jealous of me? I asked incredulously. I tried to imagine a universe in which someone as breathtaking as Rosalie would have any possible reason to feel jealous of someone like me. You're human, he shrugged. She wishes that she were too. Oh, I muttered, still stunned. Even Jasper, though, that's really my fault, he said. I told you he was the most recent to try our way of life. I warned him to keep his distance. I thought about the reason for that and shuddered. Esme and Carlyle, I continued quickly to keep him from noticing, are happy to see me happy. Actually, Esme wouldn't care if you had a third eye and webbed feet. All this time she's been worried about me, afraid that there was something missing from my essential makeup, that I was too young when Carlyle changed me. She's ecstatic. Every time I touch you, she just about chokes with satisfaction. Alice seems very enthusiastic. Alice has her own way of looking at things, he said through tight lips. And you're not going to explain that, are you? A moment of wordless communication passed between us. He realized that he knew he was keeping something from me. I realized that he wasn't going to give anything away. Not now. So what was Carlyle telling you before? His eyebrows pulled together. You noticed that, did you? I shrugged. Of course. He looked at me thoughtfully for a few seconds before answering. He wanted to tell me some news. He didn't know if it was something I would share with you, Will you? I have to, because I'm going to be a little overbearingly protective over the next few days, or weeks. And I wouldn't want you to think I'm naturally a tyrant. What's wrong? Nothing's wrong, exactly. Alice just sees some visitors coming soon. They know we're here, and they're curious. Visitors? Yes, well, they aren't like us, of course, in their hunting habits, I mean. They probably won't come into town at all, but I'm certainly not going to let you out of my sight till they're gone. I shivered. Finally, a rational response, he murmured. I was beginning to think you had no sense of self-preservation at all. I let that one pass, looking away, my eyes wandering again around the spacious room. He followed my gaze. Not what you expected, is it? He asked, his voice smug. No, I admitted. No coffins, no piled skulls in the corners. I don't even think we have cobwebs. What a disappointment this must be for you, he continued slyly. I ignored his teasing. It's so light, so open. He was more serious when he answered. It's the one place we never have to hide. The song he was still playing, my song, drifted to an end, the final chord shifting to a more melancholy key. The last note hovered poignantly in the silence. Thank you, I murmured. I realized there were tears in my eyes. I dabbed at them, embarrassed. He touched the corner of my eye, trapping one I missed. He lifted his finger, examining the drop of moisture broodingly. Then, so quickly I couldn't be positive that he really did, he put his finger to his mouth to taste it. I looked at him questioningly, and he gazed back for a long moment before he finally smiled. Do you want to see the rest of the house? No coffins, I verified, the sarcasm in my voice not entirely masking the slight but genuine anxiety I felt. He laughed, taking my hand, leading me away from the piano. No coffins, he promised. We walked up the massive staircase, my hand trailing along the satin-smooth rail. The long hall at the top of the stairs was paneled with a honey-colored wood, the same as the floorboards. Rosalie and Emmett's room, Carlyle's office, Alice's room, he gestured as he led me past the doors. He would have continued, but I stopped dead at the end of the hall, staring incredulously at the ornament hanging on the wall above my head. Edward chuckled at my bewildered expression. You can laugh, he said. It is sort of ironic. I didn't laugh. My hand raised automatically, one finger extended as if to touch the large wooden cross, its dark patina contrasting with the lighter tone of the wall. I didn't touch it, though I was curious if the aged wood would feel as silky as it looked. It must be very old, I gasped. He shrugged. Early 1630s, more or less. I looked away from the cross to stare at him. Why do you keep this here? I wondered. Nostalgia. It belonged to Carlyle's father. He collected antiques? I suggested doubtfully. No, he carved this himself. It hung on the wall above the pulpit in the vicarage where he preached. I wasn't sure if my face betrayed my shock, but I returned to gazing at the simple ancient cross just in case. I quickly did the mental math. The cross was over 370 years old. The silence stretched on as I struggled to wrap my mind around the concept of so many years. Are you all right? He sounded worried. How old is Carlyle? I asked quietly, ignoring his question, still staring up. He just celebrated his 362nd birthday, Edward said. I looked back at him, a million questions in my eyes. He watched me carefully as he spoke. Carlyle was born in London in the 1640s, he believes. Time wasn't marked as accurately then for the common people anyway. It was just before Cromwell's rule, though. I kept my face composed, aware of his scrutiny as I listened. It was easier if I didn't try to believe. He was the only son of an Anglican pastor. His mother died giving birth to him. His father was an intolerant man. As the Protestants came into power, he was enthusiastic in his persecution of Roman Catholics and other religions. He also believed very strongly in the reality of evil. He led hunts for witches, werewolves, and vampires. I grew very still at the word. I'm sure he noticed, but he went on without pausing. They burned a lot of innocent people. Of course, the real creatures that he sought were not so easy to catch. When the pastor grew old, he placed his obedient son in charge of the raids. At first, Carlyle was a disappointment. He was not quick to accuse, to see demons where they did not exist. But he was persistent and more clever than his father. He actually discovered a coven of true vampires that lived hidden in the sewers of the city, only coming out by night to hunt. In those days, when monsters were not just myths and legends, that was the way many lived. The people gathered their pitchforks and torches, of course. His brief laugh was darker now, and waited where Carlyle had seen the monsters exit into the street. Eventually, one emerged. His voice was very quiet. I strained to catch the words. He must have been ancient and weak with hunger. Carlyle heard him call out in Latin to the others when he caught the scent of the mob. He ran through the streets, and Carlyle, he was 23 and very fast, was in the lead of the pursuit. The creature could have easily outrun them, but Carlyle thinks he was too hungry, so he turned and attacked. He fell on Carlyle first, but the others were close behind, and he turned to defend himself. He killed two men and made off with a third, leaving Carlyle bleeding in the street. He paused. I could sense he was editing something, keeping something from me. Carlyle knew what his father would do. The bodies would be burned. Anything infected by the monster must be destroyed. Carlyle acted instinctively to save his own life. He crawled away from the alley while the mob followed the fiend and his victim. He hid in a cellar, buried himself in rotting potatoes for 3 days. It's a miracle he was able to keep silent, to stay undiscovered. It was over then, and he realized what he had become. I'm not sure what my face was revealing, but he suddenly broke off. How are you feeling? He asked. I'm fine, I assured him. And though I bit my lip in hesitation, he must have seen the curiosity burning in my eyes. He smiled. I expect you have a few more questions for me? A few. His smile widened over his brilliant teeth. He started back down the hall, pulling me along by the hand. Come on, then, he encouraged. I'll show you. Chapter 16. Carlyle. He led me back to the room that he'd pointed out as Carlyle's office. He paused outside the door for an instant. Come in, Carlyle's voice invited. Edward opened the door to a high-ceilinged room with tall, west-facing windows. The walls were paneled again, in a darker wood, where they were visible. Most of the wall space was taken up by towering bookshelves that reached high above my head and held more books than I'd ever seen outside a library. Carlyle sat behind a huge mahogany desk in a leather chair. He was just placing a bookmark in the pages of the thick volume he held. The room was how I'd always imagined a college dean's would look. Only Carlyle looked too young to fit the part. What can I do for you? He asked us pleasantly, rising from his seat. I wanted to show Bella some of our history, Edward said. Well, your history, actually. We didn't mean to disturb you, I apologized. Not at all. Where are you going to start? The Wagoner, Edward replied, placing one hand lightly on my shoulder and spinning me around to look back toward the door we'd just come through. Every time he touched me, in even the most casual way, my heart had an audible reaction. It was more embarrassing with Carlyle there. The wall we face now was different from the others. Instead of bookshelves, this wall was crowded with framed pictures of all sizes, some in vibrant colors, others dull monochromes. I searched for some logic, some binding motif the collection had in common, but I found nothing in my hasty examination. Edward pulled me toward the far left side, standing me in front of a small square oil painting in a plain wooden frame. This one did not stand out among the bigger and brighter pieces. Painted in varying tones of sepia, it depicted a miniature city full of steeply slanted roofs, with thin spires atop a few scattered towers. A wide river filled the foreground, crossed by a bridge covered with structures that looked like tiny cathedrals. "London in the 1650s, Edward said. "The London of my youth," Carlyle added, from a few feet behind us. I flinched. I hadn't heard him approach. Edward squeezed my hand. "Will you tell the story?" Edward asked. I twisted a little to see Carlyle's reaction. He met my glance and smiled. "I would," he replied, "but I'm actually running a bit late. The hospital called this morning. Dr. Snow is taking a sick day. Besides, you know the stories as well as I do," he added, grinning at Edward now. It was a strange combination to absorb. The everyday concerns of the town doctor stuck in the middle of a discussion of his early days in 17th century London. It was also unsettling to know that he spoke aloud only for my benefit. After another warm smile for me, Carlyle left the room. I stared at the little picture of Carlyle's hometown for a long moment. "What happened then?" I finally asked, staring up at Edward, who was watching me. "When he realized what had happened to him." He glanced back to the paintings, and I looked to see which image caught his interest now. It was a larger landscape in dull fall colors. An empty, shadowed meadow in a forest, with a craggy peak in the distance. "When he knew what he had become," Edward said quietly, "he rebelled against it. He tried to destroy himself, but that's not easily done." "How?" I didn't mean to say it aloud, but the word broke through my shock. "He jumped from great heights," Edward told me, his voice impassive. "He tried to drown himself in the ocean. But he was young to the new life and very strong. It was amazing that he was able to resist feeding while he was still so new. The instinct is more powerful then. It takes over everything. But he was so repelled by himself that he had the strength to try to kill himself with starvation." "Is that possible?" My voice was faint. "No, there are very few ways we can be killed." I opened my mouth to ask, but he spoke before I could. "So he grew very hungry, and eventually weak. He strayed as far as he could from the human populace, recognizing that his willpower was weakening too. For months he wandered by night, seeking the loneliest places, loathing himself. One night, a herd of deer passed his hiding place. He was so wild with thirst that he attacked without a thought. His strength returned, and he realized there was an alternative to being the vile monster he feared. Had he not eaten venison in his former life? Over the next months, his new philosophy was born. He could exist without being a demon. He found himself again. He began to make better use of his time. He'd always been intelligent, eager to learn. Now he had unlimited time before him. He studied by night, planned by day. He swam to France? "People swim the channel all the time, Bella," he reminded me patiently. "That's true, I guess. It just sounded funny in that context. Go on." "Swimming is easy for us." "Everything is easy for you," I griped. He waited, his expression amused. "I won't interrupt again, I promise." He chuckled darkly and finished his sentence. "Because technically, we don't need to breathe." You promised, he laughed, putting his cold finger lightly to my lips. "Do you want to hear the story or not?" "You can't spring something like that on me and then expect me not to say anything," I mumbled against his finger. He lifted his hand, moving it to rest against my neck. The speed of my heart reacted to that, but I persisted. "You don't have to breathe?" I demanded. "No, it's not necessary. Just a habit," he shrugged. "How long can you go without breathing?" "Indefinitely, I suppose. I don't know. It gets a bit uncomfortable, being without a sense of smell." A bit uncomfortable, I echoed. I wasn't paying attention to my own expression, but something in it made him grow somber. His hand dropped to his side and he stood very still, his eyes intent on my face. The silence lengthened. His features were immobile as stone. What is it? I whispered, touching his frozen face. His face softened under my hand and he sighed. I keep waiting for it to happen. For what to happen? I know that at some point, something I tell you or something you see is going to be too much. And then you'll run away from me, screaming as you go. He smiled half a smile, but his eyes were serious. I won't stop you. I want this to happen because I want you to be safe. And yet, I want to be with you. The two desires are impossible to reconcile. He trailed off, staring at my face, waiting. I'm not running anywhere, I promised. We'll see, he said, smiling again. I frowned at him. So go on. Carlyle was swimming to France. He paused, getting back into his story. Reflexively, his eyes flickered to another picture, the most colorful of them all, the most ornately framed, and the largest. It was twice as wide as the door it hung next to. The canvas overflowed with bright figures in swirling robes, writhing around long pillars and off marbled balconies. I couldn't tell if it represented Greek mythology or if the characters floating in the clouds above were meant to be biblical. Carlyle swam to France and continued on through Europe to the universities there. By night, he studied music, science, medicine, and found his calling, his penance in that, in saving human lives. His expression became awed, almost reverent. I can't adequately describe the struggle. It took Carlyle 2 centuries of torturous effort to perfect his self-control. Now he is all but immune to the scent of human blood, and he is able to do the work he loves without agony. He finds a great deal of peace there, at the hospital. Edward stared off into space for a long moment. Suddenly, he seemed to recall his purpose. He tapped his finger against the huge painting in front of us. He was studying in Italy when he discovered the others there. They were much more civilized and educated than the wraiths of the London sewers. He touched a comparatively sedate quartet of figures painted on the highest balcony, looking down calmly on the mayhem below them. I examined the grouping carefully and realized, with a startled laugh, that I recognized the golden-haired man. Solomina was greatly inspired by Carlyle's friends. He often painted them as gods, Edward chuckled. Ero, Marcus, Caius, he said, indicating the other 3, 2 black-haired, 1 snowy-white. Nighttime patrons of the arts. What happened to them? I wondered aloud, my fingertip hovering a centimeter from the figures on the canvas. They're still there, he shrugged, as they have been for who knows how many millennia. Carlyle stayed with them only for a short time, just a few decades. He greatly admired their civility, their refinement, but they persisted in trying to cure his aversion to his natural food source, as they called it. They tried to persuade him, and he tried to persuade them, to no avail. At that point, Carlyle decided to try the new world. He dreamed of finding others like himself. He was very lonely, you see. He didn't find anyone for a long time. But as monsters became the stuff of fairy tales, he found he could interact with unsuspecting humans as if he were one of them. He began practicing medicine, but the companionship he craved evaded him. He couldn't risk familiarity. When the influenza epidemic hit, he was working nights in a hospital in Chicago. He'd been turning over an idea in his mind for several years, and he had almost decided to act. Since he couldn't find a companion, he would create one. He wasn't absolutely sure how his own transformation had occurred, so he was hesitant, and he was loath to steal anyone's life the way his had been stolen. It was in that frame of mind that he found me. There was no hope for me. I was left in a ward with the dying. He had nursed my parents, and knew I was alone. He decided to try. His voice, nearly a whisper now, trailed off. He stared unseeingly through the west windows. I wondered which images filled his mind now, Carlyle's memories or his own. I waited quietly. When he turned back to me, a gentle angel smile lit his expression. "And so we've come full circle," he concluded. "Have you always stayed with Carlyle then?" I wondered. "Almost always." He put his hand lightly on my waist and pulled me with him as he walked through the door. I stared back at the wall of pictures, wondering if I would ever get to hear the other stories. Edward didn't say any more as we walked down the hall, so I asked, "Almost?" He sighed, seeming reluctant to answer. "Well, I had a typical bout of rebellious adolescence, about 10 years after I was born, created, whatever you want to call it. I wasn't sold on his life of abstinence, and I resented him for curbing my appetite, so I went off on my own for a time." "Really?" I was intrigued rather than frightened, as I perhaps should have been. He could tell. I vaguely realized that we were headed up the next flight of stairs, but I wasn't paying much attention to my surroundings. "That doesn't repulse you?" "No. Why not?" "I guess it sounds reasonable." He barked a laugh more loudly than before. We were at the top of the stairs now in another paneled hallway. "From the time of my new birth," he murmured, "I had the advantage of knowing what everyone around me was thinking, both human and non-human alike. That's why it took me 10 years to defy Carlyle. I could read his perfect sincerity, understand exactly why he lived the way he did. It took me only a few years to return to Carlyle and recommit to his vision. I thought I would be exempt from the depression that accompanies a conscience. Because I knew the thoughts of my prey, I could pass over the innocent and pursue only the evil. If I followed a murderer down a dark alley where he stalked a young girl, if I saved her, then surely I wasn't so terrible." I shivered, imagining only too clearly what he described. The alley at night, the frightened girl, the dark man behind her. And Edward. Edward as he hunted, terrible and glorious as a young god, unstoppable. Would she have been grateful, that girl, or more frightened than before? But as time went on, I began to see the monster in my eyes. I couldn't escape the debt of so much human life taken, no matter how justified. And I went back to Carlyle and Esme. They welcomed me back like the prodigal. It was more than I deserved. We'd come to a stop in front of the last door in the hall. "My room," he informed me, opening it and pulling me through. His room faced south, with a wall-sized window like the great room below. The whole backside of the house must be glass. His view looked down on the winding Soul Duck River, across the untouched forest to the Olympic mountain range. The mountains were much closer than I would have believed. The western wall was completely covered with shelf after shelf of CDs. His room was better stocked than a music store. In the corner was a sophisticated-looking sound system, the kind I was afraid to touch because I'd be sure to break something. There was no bed, only a wide and inviting black leather sofa. The floor was covered with a thick golden carpet, and the walls were hung with heavy fabric in a slightly darker shade. "Good acoustics?" I guessed. He chuckled and nodded. He picked up a remote and turned the stereo on. It was quiet, but the soft jazz number sounded like the band was in the room with us. I went to look at his mind-boggling music collection. "How do you have these organized?" I asked, unable to find any rhyme or reason to the titles. He wasn't paying attention. "By year, and then by personal preference within that frame," he said absently. I turned, and he was looking at me with a peculiar expression in his eyes. "What?" I was prepared to feel relieved. having you know about everything, not needing to keep secrets from you. But I didn't expect to feel more than that. I like it. It makes me happy, he shrugged, smiling slightly. I'm glad, I said, smiling back. I'd worried that he might regret telling me these things. It was good to know that wasn't the case. But then, as his eyes dissected my expression, his smile faded and his forehead creased. You're still waiting for the running and the screaming, aren't you? I guessed. A faint smile touched his lips, and he nodded. I hate to burst your bubble, but you're really not as scary as you think you are. I don't find you scary at all, actually. I lied casually. He stopped, raising his eyebrows in blatant disbelief. Then he flashed a wide, wicked smile. You really shouldn't have said that, he chuckled. He growled, a low sound in the back of his throat. His lips curled back over his perfect teeth. His body shifted suddenly, half crouched, tensed like a lion about to pounce. I backed away from him, glaring. You wouldn't. I didn't see him leap at me. It was much too fast. I only found myself suddenly airborne, and then we crashed onto the sofa, knocking it into the wall. All the while, his arms formed an iron cage of protection around me. I was barely jostled. But I still was gasping as I tried to right myself. He wasn't having that. He curled me into a ball against his chest, holding me more securely than iron chains. I glared at him in alarm, but he seemed well in control, his jaw relaxed as he grinned, his eyes bright only with humor. You were saying, he growled playfully, that you are a very, very terrifying monster, I said, my sarcasm marred a bit by my breathless voice. Much better, he approved. I struggled. Can I get up now? He just laughed. Can we come in? A soft voice sounded from the hall. I struggled to free myself, but Edward merely readjusted me so that I was somewhat more conventionally seated on his lap. I could see it was Alice then, and Jasper behind her in the doorway. My cheeks burned, but Edward seemed at ease. Go ahead, Edward was still chuckling quietly. Alice seemed to find nothing unusual in our embrace. She walked, almost danced. Her movements were so graceful, to the center of the room, where she folded herself sinuously onto the floor. Jasper, however, paused at the door, his expression a trifle shocked. He stared at Edward's face, and I wondered if he was tasting the atmosphere with his unusual sensitivity. It sounded like you were having Bella for lunch, and we came to see if you would share, Alice announced. I stiffened for an instant, until I realized Edward was grinning. Whether at her comment or my response, I couldn't tell. Sorry, I don't believe I have enough to spare, he replied, his arms holding me recklessly close. Actually, Jasper said, smiling despite himself as he walked into the room, Alice says there's going to be a real storm tonight, and Emmett wants to play ball. Are you game? The words were all common enough, but the context confused me. I gathered that Alice was a bit more reliable than the weatherman, though. Edward's eyes lit up, but he hesitated. Of course you should bring Bella, Alice chirped. I thought I saw Jasper throw a quick glance at her. Do you want to go? Edward asked me, excited, his expression vivid. Sure. I couldn't disappoint such a face. Where are we going? We have to wait for thunder to play ball. You'll see why, he promised. Will I need an umbrella? They all three laughed aloud. Will she? Jasper asked Alice. No, she was positive. The storm will hit over town. It should be dry enough in the clearing. Good then. The enthusiasm in Jasper's voice was catching, naturally. I found myself eager rather than scared stiff. Let's go see if Carlisle will come. Alice bounded up and to the door in a fashion that would break any ballerina's heart. Like you don't know, Jasper teased, and they were swiftly on their way. Jasper managed to inconspicuously close the door behind them. What will we be playing? I demanded. You will be watching, Edward clarified. We will be playing baseball. I rolled my eyes. Vampires like baseball? It's the American pastime, he said with mock solemnity. Chapter 17. The Game. It was just beginning to drizzle when Edward turned onto my street. Up until that moment, I'd had no doubt that he'd be staying with me while I spent a few interim hours in the real world. And then I saw the black car, a weathered Ford parked in Charlie's driveway, and heard Edward mutter something unintelligible in a low, harsh voice. Leaning away from the rain under the shallow front porch, Jacob Black stood behind his father's wheelchair. Billy's face was impassive as stone as Edward parked my truck against the curb. Jacob stared down, his expression mortified. Edward's low voice was furious. This is crossing the line. He came to warn Charlie? I guessed, more horrified than angry. Edward just nodded, answering Billy's gaze through the rain with narrowed eyes. I felt weak with relief that Charlie wasn't home yet. Let me deal with this, I suggested. Edward's black glare made me anxious. To my surprise, he agreed. That's probably best. Be careful, though. The child has no idea. I bridled a little at the word child. Jacob is not that much younger than I am, I reminded him. He looked at me then, his anger abruptly fading. Oh, I know, he assured me with a grin. I sighed and put my hand on the door handle. Get them inside, he instructed, so I can leave. I'll be back around dusk. Do you want my truck? I offered, meanwhile wondering how I would explain its absence to Charlie. He rolled his eyes. I could walk home faster than this truck moves. You don't have to leave, I said wistfully. He smiled at my glum expression. Actually, I do. After you get rid of them, he threw a dark glance in the Black's direction, you still have to prepare Charlie to meet your new boyfriend. He grinned widely, showing all of his teeth. I groaned. Thanks a lot. He smiled the crooked smile that I loved. I'll be back soon, he promised. His eyes flickered back to the porch, and then he leaned in to swiftly kiss me just under the edge of my jaw. My heart lurched frantically, and I too glanced toward the porch. Billy's face was no longer impassive, and his hands clutched at the armrests of his chair. Soon, I stressed as I opened the door and stepped out into the rain. I could feel his eyes on my back as I half ran through the light sprinkle toward the porch. Hey, Billy. Hi, Jacob. I greeted them as cheerfully as I could manage. Charlie's gone for the day. I hope you haven't been waiting long. Not long, Billy said in a subdued tone. His black eyes were piercing. I just wanted to bring this up. He indicated a brown paper sack resting in his lap. Thanks, I said, though I had no idea what it could be. Why don't you come in for a minute and dry off? I pretended to be oblivious to his intense scrutiny as I unlocked the door and waved them in ahead of me. Here, let me take that, I offered, turning to shut the door. I allowed myself one last glance at Edward. He was waiting, perfectly still, his eyes solemn. You'll want to put it in the fridge, Billy noted as he handed me the package. It's some of Harry Clearwater's homemade fish fry, Charlie's favorite. The fridge keeps it drier. He shrugged. Thanks, I repeated, but with feeling this time. I was running out of new ways to fix fish, and he's bound to bring home more tonight. Fishing again? Billy asked with a subtle gleam in his eye. Down at the usual spot? Maybe I'll run by and see him. No, I quickly lied, my face going hard. He was headed someplace new, but I have no idea where. He took in my changed expression, and it made him thoughtful. Jake, he said, still appraising me, why don't you go get that new picture of Rebecca out of the car? I'll leave that for Charlie, too. Where is it? Jacob asked, his voice morose. I glanced at him, but he was staring at the floor, his eyebrows pulling together. I think I saw it in the trunk, Billy said. You may have to dig for it. Jacob slouched back out into the rain. Billy and I faced each other in silence. After a few seconds, the quiet started to feel awkward, so I turned and headed to the kitchen. I could hear his wet wheels squeak against the linoleum as he followed. I shoved the bag onto the crowded top shelf of the fridge and spun around to confront him. His deeply lined face was unreadable. Charlie won't be back for a long time. My voice was almost rude. He nodded in agreement but said nothing. Thanks again for the fish fry, I hinted. He continued nodding. I sighed and folded my arms across my chest. He seemed to sense that I had given up on small talk. Bella, he said, and then he hesitated. I waited. Bella, he said again. Charlie is one of my best friends. Yes? He spoke each word carefully in his rumbling voice. I noticed you've been spending time with one of the Cullens. Yes, I repeated curtly. His eyes narrowed. Maybe it's none of my business, but I don't think that is such a good idea. You're right, I agreed. It is none of your business. He raised his graying eyebrows at my tone. You probably don't know this, but the Cullen family has an unpleasant reputation on the reservation. Actually, I did know that, I informed him in a hard voice. This surprised him. But that reputation couldn't be deserved, could it? Because the Cullens never set foot on the reservation, do they? I could see that my less than subtle reminder of the agreement that both bound and protected his tribe pulled him up short. That's true, he acceded, his eyes guarded. You seem well informed about the Cullens. More informed than I expected. I stared him down. Maybe even better informed than you are. He pursed his thick lips as he considered that. Maybe, he allowed, but his eyes were shrewd. Is Charlie as well informed? He had found the weak chink in my armor. Charlie likes the Cullens a lot, I hedged. He clearly understood my evasion. His expression was unhappy but unsurprised. It's not my business, he said, but it may be Charlie's. Though it would be my business again whether or not I think that it's Charlie's business, right? I wondered if he even understood my confused question as I struggled not to say anything compromising, but he seemed to. He thought about it while the rain picked up against the roof, the only sound breaking the silence. Yes, he finally surrendered. I guess that's your business too. I sighed with relief. Thanks, Billy. Just think about what you're doing, Bella, he urged. Okay, I agreed quickly. He frowned. What I meant to say was, don't do what you're doing. I looked into his eyes, filled with nothing but concern for me, and there was nothing I could say. Just then the front door banged loudly, and I jumped at the sound. There's no picture anywhere in that car. Jacob's complaining voice reached us before he did. The shoulders of his shirt were stained with the rain, his hair dripping when he rounded the corner. Billy grunted, suddenly detached, spinning his chair around to face his son. I guess I left it at home. Jacob rolled his eyes dramatically. Great. Well, Bella, tell Charlie... Billy paused before continuing. That we stopped by, I mean. I will, I muttered. Jacob was surprised. Are we leaving already? Charlie's gonna be out late, Billy explained as he rolled himself past Jacob. Oh, Jacob looked disappointed. Well, I guess I'll see you later then, Bella. Sure, I agreed. Take care, Billy warned me. I didn't answer. Jacob helped his father out the door. I waved briefly, glancing swiftly toward my now empty truck, and then shut the door before they were gone. I stood in the hallway for a minute, listening to the sound of their car as it backed out and drove away. I stayed where I was, waiting for the irritation and anxiety to subside. When the tension eventually faded a bit, I headed upstairs to change out of my dressy clothes. I tried on a couple of different tops, not sure what to expect tonight. As I concentrated on what was coming, what had just passed became insignificant. Now that I was removed from Jasper's and Edward's influence, I began to make up for not being